Hello, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Dunaway, here in the studio with my co-host, Dean Welty. And as you all know, we've recently turned the page on a new chapter for America with the inauguration of President Joe Biden as our nation's 46th president. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about how we as Christians should behave toward a president whose values are so very different from our own. We also talked about some of the policies we should be looking out for based on Biden's past actions throughout the course of his very long tenure in public office. But today, we'll focus in on one particular aspect of President Biden's public policy views. It's what he calls his agenda for women. Yes, that is what it's called. And there are a lot of reasons for us to be concerned about this. You're laughing, Dean. Would you agree with that?
Rita, I have to confess I'm not a woman. So I'm not sure what to say about this agenda for women. So I'm looking to you to educate me on this. But yes, I get more concerned every day, Rita, for reasons that you seem to be hinting at. In addition to his agenda for women that we'll be talking about today. But Rita, before we get to that, I want to take just a moment to give a brief recap for our listeners from our discussion of a couple weeks ago. We talked at that time, and you hinted at it here, about the importance, especially for us as Christians, to be gentle with people even when we need to be tough with them on the issues. And you made very clear that no matter how vehemently we disagree with our president or anyone else for that matter, we should treat them with courtesy and civility. Okay, I have to agree with that.
Oh, good.
We should treat them with courtesy and civility. But, Rita, there is a growing challenge for many of us when it comes to how to relate to President Biden and his agenda, not just for women, but for all of America. It's tough.
Yeah, I know that's true because of how strong our differences are with him and his administration on so many issues. And today's issue of Biden's women's agenda is a perfect example. There is so much packed in there, and much of it is very concerning. Dean, it's over 11,000 words. And just to give a point of reference for our listeners, the entire U.S. Constitution is only 4,543 words. So President Biden's agenda for women is more than double the length of the whole Constitution. And that's just his agenda for women, Dean.
It raises the question of why we need to even have an agenda for women at all.
Yeah.
For example, Rita, now think about this carefully. If women get a special agenda, don't we also need a special agenda for men?
Sure seems like it.
So like you, I'm troubled by this agenda, and I'll get even more troubled, I'm afraid, as you develop it, and other agendas like it, because they all seem to contradict what President said in his inaugural address about the importance of unity. In fact, the record number of executive actions that he signed immediately after the inauguration seemed to divide us all up into so many different interest groups, rather than treating us as one American people who have common interests. It is the direct opposite of our original national motto of E Pluribus Unum. I'm not good at Latin, but it seems like it's E Unum Pluribus. Exactly opposite of what we should be doing, and I don't like it. Instead of working to bring us together as one nation under God, President Biden seems to be tearing us apart by our differences, especially our differences in color and gender.
And Dean, that is really borne out by his campaign website, which is where I got this agenda for women. He has, as we mentioned a couple weeks ago, 48 different plans, and many of them, that is exactly what they do. They they take one little group of Americans, African Americans or Hispanic Americans, they divide us all up, and then he seems to have a different plan for each group of people. And I just have a hard time with that. That's not what our government should be about. They should be focused on the interests that unite us all as Americans.
It's a balkanization of our country. We're not only divided up into so many different groups, we are pitted against each other for our special interests. But tell us now, what is this agenda for women all about?
Well, President Biden's plan is ostensibly all about, and I quote, protecting and empowering women around the world, end quote. As a woman, I'm all for women being empowered and protected. But right off the bat, I have to say I'm skeptical about how the federal government wants to do that.
Well, I think you're right to be skeptical, Rita, and I'm reminded of something that Ronald Reagan once said. The 9 most terrifying words in the English language, and you know what they are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Oh, dear.
But
no,
President
thanks.
Biden's agenda for women isn't just for American women, is it? It seems that he also plans to protect and empower women around the world. Again, a noble goal. But is that really a part of his constitutional duties as President of the United States?
That is another important question for us to be asking. And in a little bit, we're going to get into the impact of his plans on women in other countries. But I think the question we're really trying to answer is, are these plans really going to benefit women, either here or abroad?
As I see it, the first broad category of plans that he laid out involves various forms of affirmative action type of policies that are really meant to help women economically and financially. For example, he starts out with the premise that, and I quote, women, particularly women of color, have never had a fair shot to get ahead in this country. And so he wants to be helpful. So to correct that, he vows to make sure that his cabinet members look like the country they serve. Well, somehow, he takes that premise to justify him in giving federal funding to women-owned businesses. Well, that's a real incentive to be a transgender, isn't it?
Oh.
I'll get some more funding if I identify myself as a woman. Well, Rita, it's up to you to evaluate this. You ought to welcome this, correct? How do you see it being a woman?
Dean, I don't like it at all, and I'll tell you why. Affirmative action plans like these imply that women are unable to compete with men in areas where we absolutely can and do it quite well. Thank you very much. Biden's agenda specifically mentions, as you said, choosing cabinet members, and it mentions awarding government contracts. However, there is absolutely no reason why women can't compete with men on equal terms for a seat on the cabinet or for a contract in the business world. The idea that we need some kind of artificial help from President Biden in order to compete in those areas is offensive to me, and it should be offensive to all self-respecting women. I don't think that most of us want to be chosen for an honor just because of our gender. We want to be chosen because we are good at what we do and we have something unique to contribute. And because that is equally as true of women as it is of men, we don't need these boosts from Biden. But Dean, I'm curious, as a white man, what are your thoughts on affirmative action policies?
I'm good for affirmative action policies as long as I'm the beneficiary of the affirmation.
I don't believe that. I think you're being facetious.
Well,
there.
It's a joke, and we'll get into it a little bit more with some examples that I've experienced. Mm-hmm. But Rita, you asked about how I feel about it. I can't say it any better than what Martin Luther King Jr. said when he said, I look to a day, and he was talking about his sons as well, when people will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, and he could have said the same thing about gender. We need to remind ourselves of that every day. We are created equal in the image of God.
You know, I first read that speech by Martin Luther King Jr. as a middle school student, and I was so inspired by it. In fact, I would say the truth of that, the impact of that statement that you just read, was one of the things that led me to want to write and to do the kind of work that I do today, because those words just ring true. Yes. People should be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. When we see these kinds of proposals that Biden is making, as you pointed out before, that carve Americans into all these different sects and then bestow favors on some of them, we should ask ourselves, do we want government to be some kind of equalizer in terms of giving out material goods, or do we want government to be fair? It can't be both. Should government be the referee or the coach?
That's a tension, actually, in our policymakers today. Yes, we want equal opportunity.
Yes.
But that doesn't guarantee equal outcome.
That's right.
That's our responsibility.
Yeah.
So that's interesting, Rita, what you talk about being a referee or a coach. It takes me back to a time in the State Department when my job was to help place senior foreign service officers as ambassadors, as deputy chiefs of mission, to put them into responsible positions that fit their skills and their experience. Well, it seemed pretty straightforward to me. You just look at the record. But it was also a time when I was doing this that race and gender were becoming more important factors in considering how we make our decisions. Our culture was changing on those two areas. And there's an example I distinctly remember when someone suggested it, again, talking to people like me who were making assignments. Well, he said, I think we ought to put a photograph of each officer on their applications. Well, supposedly, that would allow us to give extra points for applicants on the basis of their skin color or their gender. And it was a new thought for me. Not only for me, it was a new thought for officers who appeared to be the best qualified for a particular position, but they lost out to a candidate of another color or gender.
That doesn't seem like justice or fairness.
It's not right. And there were clear cases of what we now refer to as reverse discrimination, which is what this is, it seems. Or other people might see it as affirmative action. So it depends on your point of view.
Yeah.
My view is it wasn't right then, and it isn't right now. At the end of the day, it's not the government's job to put its hand on the scales of fairness and justice, at least not in these areas.
That's right. I totally agree, Dean. The core of government's role in a free society is to be a referee, not a coach. It's to enforce the rules and punish those who break them, to preserve order and protect our liberties. The worst thing, though, I think, is for a person who's dressed up in a ref uniform and has this appearance of being the one who's fair and equal to give some players advantages over others. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion back in the revolutionary era in the founding times about whether government was meant to have a negative role or a positive role. And what I mean by that is government supposed to be actively transforming the society and trying to make society a better place to live? Or is the role of government to interfere when protection is necessary or where punishment is necessary? And the founders were of the view that it was the latter. It's the job of people, families, private institutions, churches, to make the country a better place. It's the government's job to be fair and enforce the rules and to see that justice is done.
And I think it's a good reminder of the preamble to the Constitution. It's about we the people.
That's right.
We are the government. And that's why I like the symbol, Rita, of a blind Lady Justice holding her scales without fear or favor. And I like to think, you talked about this a minute ago, that there's a level playing field for all of us. We know what's expected. We know that we have to prepare ourselves for the demand and responsibilities of life. We know we have to follow the rules, and we give it our best shot. And it reminds me, Rita, of our good friend, Bishop E.W. Jackson. His parents had broken up, and he was on his own. He wasn't doing well. He was on the streets. He was failing in school. His father came and took custody of him again. And when he saw his struggling and his poor grades in school, he took him aside as a young, struggling boy, and here's what he said: success is up to you, and I will never accept an excuse for failure. That advice from his father helped turn his life around.
I believe it, Dean. And you know, that's not to say, I know neither of us is suggesting that we shouldn't help people who are down on their luck or struggling or sick or needy or whatever. Of course we should. But it's we, the church, it's people as individuals, private groups and businesses. We are the ones who should help them. That is not the role of the government.
When the government steps on the church's turf, and that's what you're really talking about, we need to go back and take that turf back.
Absolutely.
It's our responsibility. And I know, Rita, that this agenda really says a lot about abortion. So there are two sides to that debate, aren't there?
Well, I suppose so. But this, Dean, I have to say, is the most appalling part of President Biden's entire agenda for women. And it's really alarming. I know we're going to get into details, but I think everyone listening should be concerned about some of the things he's proposing here.
Just from what I've seen so far, President Biden is very outspoken in his support for repealing the Hyde Amendment, and we'll need an explanation for that. But in other words, he wants taxpayers to pay for women to have an abortion, even when that violates our deeply held religious beliefs. We have to pay for something that we think is wrong.
Yeah, that's right. On President Biden's campaign website, he said that he supports repealing the Hyde Amendment because health care is a right that should not be dependent on one's zip code or income. Doesn't that sound nice?
Color me confused. I'm not even sure what that means. Abortion is a big problem. But what does a woman's zip code or income have to do with it?
Yeah. Well, there are so many parts to this problem, Dean, that I hardly know where to start. Maybe I should start with the fact that the Supreme Court's ruling in Roe versus Wade that mothers have a constitutional right to abort their children is just dead wrong.
I can't disagree with that, and I think anyone who understands the science, we hear a lot about the science. Science says that life begins at conception, so we all have to agree with you on that. But Roe v. Wade is still standing. We have to deal with it. What else is wrong with Biden's idea that taxpayers should fund abortion? After all, as you said, he believes that health care is a right that should not be dependent on one zip code or income. It's a right.
Well, here's the next problem with it. Even if a right to abortion could really be found in the Constitution, as the Supreme Court said back in Roe versus Wade, it is a dangerous fallacy to suggest that taxpayers have to pay for every choice that a person has a right to make. That's just unsustainable.
Okay, I get that. But even though I think life is sacred from conception and that therefore abortion is wrong, what else is wrong with Biden's plan for women? That's a big one right there.
Well, you're right. There's another problem with Biden's statement, and it's a huge one. Again, he said that he supports federal funding of abortions because health care is a right. So here's the most glaring problem, Dean. Abortion is not health care. It is the purposeful killing of an innocent human being.
It reminds me of something, a program we had some time ago, that words matter.
Yeah.
Science says, confirms, that life begins at conception. So how do we reconcile that between healthcare and the evil of abortion as it stands, because the abortion industry itself labels it as health care. Yep. And so people want to believe it for their own convenience. They want to cast something evil, which is abortion, in a positive light by calling it health care. Mm-hmm. It's like what Isaiah says about people who call evil good and good evil. It's a good example of a recent, as I said, program where we talked about the importance of words. We need to call it what it is. As you said, the purposeful killing of an innocent human being. Abortion is not, repeating what you just said, it's not health care.
That's right. And the truth is that when you come right down to it, even the abortion industry knows that they are two different things. And I'll tell you my evidence for this. The Planned Parenthood website, now Planned Parenthood is the nation's largest abortion provider, and their website recently listed Biden's and Trump's stances on the issues so that people could decide how they wanted to vote. Very tellingly, their website, this is the Planned Parenthood website, listed abortion access. That was the very first issue it listed on the site, and it was a totally separate category from health care.
Wow. It looks like they stepped in their own trap of lies to me. They call it one thing when they want, when it serves their purpose,
yep.
And they recognize it as something else a little later. But even if some may link it to a woman's health, abortion is certainly not health care for its innocent victims. Let's keep in mind there's another party here. After all, the whole point of an abortion is for these little babies to die as a result of the procedure.
That's right. And the bottom line here, Dean, is that abortion does not empower women. To the contrary, it destroys some, those in the womb, and sometimes even the mothers who choose abortion. It demoralizes others, and it dehumanizes all of us for this to be going on as standard, common practice in our country. It's dehumanizing.
That reminds me, it's an important point. When we go to Washington for the March for Life, there's a long line of ladies standing in front of microphones, right in front of the Supreme Court, and they talk about the horrible effect that their abortions have had on their lives. Mm-hmm. They're part of a woman's movement called Silent No More. As they tell their stories, it's a warning for other women and even men who have suffered so much from their abortion. But there's a broader perspective. For example, under China's one-child policy, 160 million baby girls were aborted simply because the government was pressuring the parents to hold out for a boy. But it's even worse than that. It's female infanticide. After the little baby girl is delivered, it is put to death. Now, that's the same thing, frankly, as abortion. It is the death of an innocent unborn child. And I know the women in China there didn't claim to feel empowered by what they were doing. Does that sound like female empowerment to you, Rita?
Absolutely not. And you know, I read a great book on this topic years ago. The book is called Unnatural Selection. And it was written by a journalist who started out as a total women's lib type person, a feminist. She was a supporter of abortion rights, and then she got interested in this topic, and she's an investigative journalist. She went and did the research. She interviewed families. She talked to medical providers and to government officials. She talked to all kinds of people to find out how this one-child policy in China combined with sex-selective abortion had affected them, and it was terrible. And she really came out after doing all this research, really questioning the whole trope we hear about abortion as empowering women. And there was a line that she said, I probably won't get it quite right, but she asked the question, why are these 160 million baby girls missing? And she ultimately answered it, and she said, they're not missing, they're dead. They were killed because of this practice of abortion used as population control in China. And the staggering thing, Dean, is that it appears that we have not learned our lesson from the disastrous Chinese population control experiment, because President Biden has also promised to revoke the Mexico City policy. And what the Mexico City policy does is to bar the United States from including abortion services in global health efforts that it funds in other countries. And, you know, before we go on and talk about that, I have to add one more thing, and that is back on the China issue. This sex-selective abortion that has been used for so many years in China to abort baby girls specifically has led to this huge population crisis, because now they have a population of men. And they don't have enough women to even marry and become mothers and carry on their population. It's a huge crisis. And how could we have not learned our lesson from it?
This really amplifies the problem we have with this agenda for women. Because the bottom line, you talked about revoking the Mexico City policy. That policy forbade the United States from sending assistance to countries overseas or organizations that were involved in abortion. So the bottom line here, Rita, as we come to a close here, is that President Biden and his administration are doing everything they can, not only to protect the evil of abortion in America, but also around the world. And to cap it off, they want to make us pay for it, even when it violates our conscience. So, Rita, we got to close. What can we do to stop this bloody chapter of American history?
Well, I'll start with the obvious. When it's time to vote, support candidates who respect the sanctity of human life from conception. And I know you've often said, Dean, that if someone doesn't have that right, they are not likely to have many other fundamental issues right, because that is the very core. And again, protecting human life is a core function of government. So we need people who understand that. Beyond that, Dean, I would encourage people to pay attention to the legislation being proposed at the state level. That's where a lot of this plays out. Pay attention to what's going on. Sign up for the Family Foundation news alert so that you know when you need to contact your state legislators. And finally, Dean, I would encourage everyone to support AvaCare, our local pregnancy center, and other places that provide support and help for women facing unplanned pregnancies.
Well, Rita, thanks a lot for bringing this to our attention. That's it for us today. We could go on for much, much more, but I'm sure we will be doing that in days ahead. So we want to thank our sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, The Wishing Well, Florists and Travel Services, and our friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren. And we also want to thank all of you for listening, your encouragement, and your financial support. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. Also, if you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to our website, valleyfamilyforum.org, and click on the link to Crossroads on the homepage. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway and our engineer, Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week. We're going to be talking about marriage and Valentine's Day, Rita. That'll give us all a little spring in our step. Join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. And until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.
Rejoice.